afternoon. Jeez, I mean that. Can we just clap it up for the choir one more time? It was awesome. It's so awesome to be here. I'm so thankful for the opportunity to celebrate this Black History Month and our history more broadly with you today. I bring you greetings from St. John's Baptist Church in the great city of Newark, New Jersey, where Pastor Phil Gilmore is the pastor. And it's really, really, I can't express to you how great an honor it is to be here today. I want to share with you that I got to the city a little early. I was to meet Jerry here at 2 o'clock, and he was taking his time. He went home and took a quick nap. And so I did get here at 2, but Jerry told me he was taking a nap, and I understood that a nap is important. So I drove around the city. I stopped at a convenience store down the street a ways to get a diet soda. My wife has put me on a no-sugar diet, so I did grab the diet soda, I promise you, but I really wanted the regular soda, but I grabbed the diet soda. And while I was there, I struck up a conversation with a gentleman who was waiting on a sandwich. And he asked me what I was doing. I said I was here to celebrate Black History Month at Shiloh Church. And he said, oh, that church changed my life. He said, I'm not really going there too tough right now, but that church changed my life. And really, it changed the whole community. So I want to share with you that even those who aren't here today who have been here before have been transformed by this church and its work. So I want to recognize Pastor Armstrong and his gracious invitation of me. Thank you to the chefs who prepared an amazing feast before we came up here. Yes. And thank you for your hospitality more broadly. I am Ryan Haygood. I'm so excited to be here. I'm an attorney with the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. That is the organization that was founded by Justice Thurgood Marshall. Jerry Harris recognizes Thurgood Marshall as the first and only African-American Supreme Court justice. I let that rest for a moment. Mr. Harris is quite critical of the existing African-American on the Supreme Court, but the LDF was formed by Thurgood Marshall almost 70 years ago. And at LDF, we tackle four major issue areas. We do voting, we do education, we do criminal justice, and we do economic justice. And I am in an interesting place in my professional career because, as Pastor mentioned, for the last 12 years I've been litigating at the Legal Defense Fund, but I am now transitioning from that national work to focus on work here at home, and I'm doing so under the tutelage of Jerry Harris, who's been so gracious. I'm moving to the New Jersey Institute for Social Justice in mid-April, where I'll be working with Jerry to focus on issues here in New Jersey. I'm very, very excited about that. And Jerry and his beautiful wife had plans to move to South Carolina very shortly, but those are going to have to wait until I get situated at the Institute. I'm excited about today. I was looking at the theme for today, and I saw that it's one Christ, one church, one community. And it's amazing that I did not know that the theme included the word community, because part of what I want to talk about today is, where do we go from here? Chaos or community? Where do we go from here? Chaos or community? And folks know that we are living in very trying times. These last few years for us, in a number of contexts, in the criminal justice context, in the voting rights context, in the education context, in the employment context, for Black folks across America, it doesn't matter where you travel to in this state or in this country, if you find Dr. Martin Luther King Boulevard, which is traditionally where you'll find us, we are suffering from a host of socioeconomic issues, substandard housing, health care, employment, criminal justice challenges. So this title for today's discussion, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, is both a critique of where we are, but also, Pastor, a challenge for us as people of faith to move our country toward community and away from the chaos. And so to the next slide, I have found, I think, an appropriate verse. I see the text is quite small, so I'll read it. And this comes from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 8. This is a very familiar passage to folks, and it is this idea of a time for everything. There is a time for everything, and a season for every activity under the heavens. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. It's a time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. Next slide. And so the challenge for us on the next slide is this question for us, which is, what time is it? And you all might remember this group here. This was a very popular group in the rap scene in the late 1980s and like early 1990s. This group was Public Enemy. And you'll remember, if you knew any of their music, that Public Enemy was really one of the pioneering black consciousness rap groups. They didn't deal with a lot of silly themes. Their music focused on ways for black people, in the face of serious structural impediments in the form of racism, could overcome those obstacles together and advance as a people. And on the right, you see Flavor Flav, who was, the group was made up of Chuck D and Flavor Flav. Flavor Flav is obviously on the right. And Flavor Flav would wear this clock around his neck. And I don't even know if the time was right, but the idea of this clock was he wanted folks to know when they saw him that the question really for black folks was, what time is it? Right? What time? Not 11:25 or as it is now 4:25, but what time is it in our society? Because Flavor Flav had the idea that people have to be mindful of the times in which we live, that we had to be critics of those times, and that we had to have solutions for advancing our cause in these trying times. Next slide, please. So I think of this idea of the time is essential to us in this moment. This is the 50th anniversary year of the Voting Rights Act. And in this time, we're called to be sober-minded about the reality that the work of protecting and advancing voting rights for people of color, and black folks in particular, it's not self-executing. Advancing and protecting voting rights for us requires our eternal vigilance. And as I think about Dr. King, this really is a time for us to recommit to taking hold to his fundamental belief that with the power of our votes, we can transform the land. That with the power of our votes, we can advocate for better educational opportunities for our communities. That with the power of our votes, we can ensure that we have a fairer criminal justice system. That with the power of our votes, we can elect responsive elected officials. Yes, it's important for us to elect candidates of color, and black folks in particular, but we don't want to elect lazy black folks, right? We don't want to do that. And we got to be honest, sometimes we get folks in office and they stay there for a very, very long time and they get lazy and they just think about their reelection. But we want to elect folks who may be black, who may not be black, who are responsive to the needs of our times. And it's interesting because in the last, next slide, several years, we have experienced a voting rights assault that has been historic, both in terms of its scope and in terms of its intensity. And I want to talk to you, I've been doing a lot of work nationally, so I want to spend a few moments sharing with you what we've seen in the last several years nationally, and then I want to bring that home and talk about what we have to do in light of those national challenges and how they influence here at home. And so when thinking about time, I was struck by this quote by William Faulkner, that the past is never dead. Indeed, it's not even past. The past is never dead. Indeed, it's not even past. And that's especially true when we think about America's relationship with democracy for black people. That's especially true when we think about our experience with democracy in this country. You know, there's never been a democracy that I could find that has enfranchised a very large group of folks, meaning given the right to vote to a large group of people, and then subsequently taken that right to vote away and then given that right to vote back. As far as I could tell, the black experience is the only experience in American history that has seen that phenomenon, the extension of the right to vote, followed by the retraction of that right to vote, followed again by giving the right to vote back. And that speaks to our relationship with democracy, which has always been a contested relationship, one that's been characterized by broad expansions of the electoral exercise, followed by attempts to constrict that democracy. And this is true, particularly, I rewound the tapes a bit looking at the Civil War, and I found that right after the Civil War, Congress moved very, very quickly to establish widespread black suffrage. Right after the Civil War, Congress was clear about the priority of giving the right to vote to black folks. Between 1866 and 1867, the percentage of black males who were eligible to vote shot up from 0.5% to 80.5%, with almost all of that increase happening in the former Confederacy, from 0.5, less than 1%, to above 80% in just 1866 to 1867. But consistent with our theme that a democracy has always been contested, that has been followed by periods of expansion and contraction, by the 1890s, just one generation after this great expansion of black office holding and black political participation, Southern legislatures moved expeditiously to extinguish voting rights for most black people. And so by 1893, there was a House report from the U.S. Congress that demanded that, quote, every trace of Reconstruction measures be wiped from the books. There was this period of expansion right after the Civil War and Reconstruction followed by contraction. And the next slide, it took nearly a century of fierce struggle to expand the electorate again. And I love these photos. These photos were really ones, next slide, which encouraged me to become a civil rights lawyer. These photos capture during the civil rights movement in black and white stills people who were courageous, who literally put themselves in harm's way to move our country away from its very high ideals of very low practices. And it took nearly a century of fierce struggle, really culminating in the Voting Rights Act of 1965, for the political franchise to be opened up for African Americans. And folks know, many of you have seen the movie Selma. It was a powerful movie which talked about the historic march, as we heard earlier, from Selma, Montgomery to Montgomery, Alabama. There was a 54-mile march. It started as an attempt to go over the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Unfortunately, on one Sunday, later known as Bloody Sunday, 600 peaceful marchers, as they rounded the top of the bridge, were met by Alabama state troopers who brutalized them, who cracked the cranium literally of now Congressman John Lewis out of Georgia, and who paralyzed others, spit on others, humiliated folks. And what was fascinating was that all was broadcast late one night as folks were watching television, largely outside of the South, and folks were horrified by the images they saw of these peaceful protesters who only wanted to dramatize to the world their desire to be treated as full citizens being brutalized in the name of democracy. Next slide. This democratic expansion was ushered in by the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And in a moment, in 2008, to borrow from the late, great Michael Jackson, Americans, truthfully, largely outside of the South, joined hands in what I like to think of as sort of a we are the world moment, to borrow from the late, great Michael Jackson, joined hands, and next slide, moved this country in 2008 and 2012 to the election of the first African-American to the White House twice. And this is a moment of democratic expansion. And this is a moment that we can celebrate as a realization of the fact that our votes matter, and that we can cast ballots to elect our candidates of choice. But as I said, and consistent with our theme, where you see democratic expansion, there is a corresponding effort to contract democracy. All right. And so following the election of an African American to the highest office in the land twice, we've seen several efforts to make voting more difficult for people of color in particular. And this is really in response to two recent developments, which I'll run through pretty quickly. One is our historic participation in the last two presidential cycles. And the second is what the 2010 census shows us. In the last two presidential election cycles, commentators have recognized that those were the most racially diverse electorates in U.S. history. In both 2012 and in 2008, Voters of color comprise a record share of the electorate, a record share of the electorate. The number of black and Latino voters increased by 2 million people apiece, up by 2 million people apiece, and significantly the total share of the white vote declined. So you have a context in 2012 and in 2008 where the voters of color comprise a record share of the electorate. Blacks, Latinos up 2 million apiece, white voters overall share declines. And the second is what the 2010 U.S. Census showed us. Demographic trends confirm that America will soon be a majority-minority nation, with the Census Bureau projecting that this tipping point will occur by 2042. For Americans who are under 18, this shift is projected to occur by 2023. What this means is that every child born in the U.S. from here on out, every child born in the U.S. from here on out will belong to the first post-majority white generation. And for us in this room, these voting and demographic trends are exciting because they speak to a political landscape in which people of color going forward will play a leading role. People of color going forward can play a leading role in the electoral franchise and the exercise of it. But it's interesting because this burgeoning political power has engendered a significant backlash in states across the country. In the face of these demographic and political trends, we've seen an assault on voting in nearly every stage of the political process, at the voter registration stage, at the early voting stage for states that have it, and on election day itself, and, as Pastor mentioned earlier, in constitutional challenges to the Voting Rights Act itself. And I want to focus on what has really become the heart of the voting rights assault, and that is the imposition of photo ID requirements, and in particular, government-issued photo ID requirements. In Texas, for example, after we lost a devastating decision, which I'll talk to you about in the Supreme Court, Texas passed a photo ID measure. It previously used allowed for a pretty expansive use of ID to vote in person. You could use your hunting or fishing license, an electric bill, a bank statement, a library card. You could use any number of IDs to prove that you were who you were on election day. But after we lost a devastating case in the Supreme Court, Texas passed a photo ID law that was one of the most restrictive laws in the country and required you to produce only one of six types of government-issued photo ID. The previous law in Texas allowed for the use of student IDs, but the most recent law wouldn't allow for student IDs, but it will allow for the use of a concealed handgun license, for example. And the rationale that Texas proffered in support of this need for this photo ID measure was voter fraud. But what was fascinating is that in support of its photo ID measure, Texas didn't produce a single instance of voter fraud. And I'm going to be very clear about the kind of voter fraud that Texas was seeking to protect against, allegedly. This is a circumstance where on election day, I, Ryan Haygood, appeared at a polling place purporting to be Pastor Armstrong. And there are credible studies that show that that simply doesn't happen, that one is more likely to be struck by lightning, truthfully, than to perceive a single instance of Ryan Haygood trying to vote as Pastor Armstrong. It just doesn't happen. But what is clear in Texas is that there are better than 1 million people, a disproportionate number of whom are black and Latino, who don't have government-issued photo ID. And in Texas, context matters. Because in the last 10 years in Texas, the population has grown by 4 million people. 90% of that growth is attributable to black and Latino growing strength. And so Texas, with an opportunity to welcome more people in light of these trends, increasing participation by people of color, and an increased share of people of color in the electorate, a chance to welcome more people into the electorate, Texas decides the latter, that it seeks to adopt a photo ID measure, knowing that more than 1 million people, a disproportionate number of whom are people of color, don't have the kind of ID that Texas is requiring. This slide. So I know this is, we have, sorry, go back one slide. So I think we have, there are folks who say, well, You know, photo ID, I mean, who doesn't? Right? Who doesn't have a photo ID? I mean, you need a photo ID to travel. When Blockbuster was still open, you needed a photo ID to rent a video, right? You need a photo ID to drive. You need a photo ID to open a bank account. You need a photo ID to exist. Who in the United States of America doesn't possess a government-issued photo ID? And what's interesting is I don't think you have to think very hard to imagine those folks, including here in Trenton, New Jersey, who don't have photo ID. And I think about those folks in Hurricane Katrina. Remember Katrina, right? There was Katrina. There was a mayor then, Ray Nagin. Remember Ray Nagin? Remember Ray Nagin? At one point, he was in a helicopter with a bullhorn. He was screaming down to the folks, particularly in the lower Ninth Ward, and he was saying, look, there's a storm coming. This is going to be the biggest storm we've ever seen. Hurricane Katrina is going to devastate New Orleans, and in particular, it's going to decimate the lower Ninth Ward. Folks, you need to get out of there immediately. And Ray Nagin's admonitions grew more and more intense as the storm got closer. And if you watched, as I did, in horror, folks in the lower Ninth Ward and in New Orleans more broadly did their best to get out of the city, right? The lines were very long. You saw cars that were in line to get gasoline. There were cars that ran out of gas. They couldn't get gas. Folks were walking. People were doing their level best to get out of the lower Ninth Ward in particular and in New Orleans more broadly. But then it happened, right? Notwithstanding Ray Nagin's admonitions that grew more and more intense until the storm came and he too had to evacuate, it happened. The storm came. There were folks who got out ahead of it, but there were others who remained and who were devastated. And we saw that video in horror, that there were those who found themselves on the tops of their homes. There were those who evacuated to the stadium. And worse, there were those who succumbed to the storm. And then there was the question for us, well, what was it about these folks that they did not get out of the storm? Did they not take the warning seriously? And the answer, quite simply, is that folks like those, like many folks in our communities here in Trenton and in Camden and in Newark and cities across the country, have been so marginalized, right? So pushed to the margins of their society that they, notwithstanding the warnings, can't get out of harm's way. Can't get out of harm's way. It's not that they don't take the harm seriously. They know what the harm is. They can see the harm, but they don't have the facility, the wherewithal to get out of harm's way. And it's on this population of people who we should be seeking to engage politically, who we should be seeking to bring into the political process, that laws like photo ID laws are so devastating. Because these are the most vulnerable in our society, and on them, photo ID measures guarantee that they can't vote in elections that require them. There are studies that show that 20% of black folks don't have government-issued photo ID. And even though we do in this room have photo ID, we know folks who don't have photo ID. We know folks who don't bank at Bank of America or Wells Fargo. We know folks who deal in cash transactions primarily. We know folks who use check cashing places. We know folks who use Rent-A-Center. We know folks who exist in the society who even drive, by the way, without photo ID issued by, right? Just be honest. Hopefully it's not your car, by the government. And so I think for us, when we think about photo ID, we have to put these in context and recognize, as the court recently did in Texas, that photo ID today is a modern-day iteration of poll tax. Texas adopted a photo ID right after we lost an important case in the Supreme Court, and we brought a challenge to Texas's photo ID law. We argued that Texas's photo ID was adopted with intentional discrimination, that it violated the Voting Rights Act, and that it was an unconstitutional poll tax. We had an expert in this case who explained that Texas, whenever black people in the state were poised to elect their candidates of choice, adopted measures to prevent them from doing so. In Texas, the very first example was the all-white primary. And Texas adopted all-white primary because they said they wanted to protect against in-person voter fraud. The Supreme Court struck the all-white primary. Texas then followed up with the poll tax, saying that they needed to adopt a poll tax to protect against in-person voter fraud. The Supreme Court struck the poll tax. Texas then moved to a voter re-registration requirement, an annual re-registration requirement, requiring its voters to register annually every year, saying they need to protect against in-person voter fraud. The Supreme Court rejected the re-registration requirement. Texas then moved to a voter purge program, where they would clean their voter registration rolls every few months because they said they needed to protect against in-person voter fraud. The Supreme Court struck that too. And then more recently, in the face of a growth in the population of 4 million people, 90% of which was black and Latino, Texas adopted the nation's most strict photo ID law, saying that they needed to protect against in-person voter fraud. And a federal district court judge struck Texas's photo ID law, finding that it was enacted with intentional discrimination, finding that it violated the Voting Rights Act, and that it represented an unconstitutional poll tax. Next slide. We talked about Hurricane Sandy, but we endured a Hurricane SCOTUS, or Hurricane Supreme Court of the United States, in a case called Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder, Hurricane SCOTUS, on which Mr. Jerry Harris's favorite judge sits, representing black folks well. And in all seriousness, this was a case involving a core provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Next slide. And it's important for, go back one slide, please. Thank you. It's important to talk about what the Voting Rights Act is, because as we commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, we have to be mindful of the way in which this devastating Supreme Court decision struck down a core provision of the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was passed at the height of the Civil Rights Movement. It was really recognized as the crown jewel of the Civil Rights Movement. And a core provision of the Voting Rights Act was Section 5. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was really kind of our democracy's discrimination checkpoint, because what it required was that all or part of some states that had a long history of discrimination in voting had to submit all of their voting changes to the federal government before they could take effect. And the theory was, look, you states have historically done really foul things when you were left to your own devices. You moved polling places from a school to a very exclusive country club 10 miles away. You changed the date of an election unbeknownst to the people in the city. You changed the qualifications for running for office, didn't tell anybody so they couldn't qualify. You kept irregular hours for registrars so people couldn't register. So you 15 or so states, whenever you want to pass a voting change, you have to seek the federal government's approval first, because we just want to make sure it's not discriminatory. And if it isn't, it can go into effect. This provision, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, in that way acted as our democracy's discrimination checkpoint. In the last 25 years, this provision rejected more than 1,000 proposed discriminatory changes. And this was a provision that was powerful in its insurance that voting measures in the places where our democracy was most replete with discriminatory devices, discriminatory efforts, would not impact the ability of people of color to vote. The Supreme Court had been reviewing the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act for many years. The most recent time was in 2012 in a case called Shelby County versus Holder, and this was a challenge brought by a county in Alabama, which was the birthplace of the Voting Rights Act, literally. And we knew that we would be challenged to go before the Supreme Court because, let's be honest, this measure is powerful. This is a measure that understood the democracy in which we live and understood our relationship with democracy that's always been contested. And this measure required states to ask for permission before they could pass any voting change. And we knew that the Supreme Court loves this idea of state sovereignty. And this measure dug into state sovereignty and said, look, you can be sovereign, but you can't discriminate in your pursuit of sovereignty. And so we were before the Supreme Court. An argument, we got some tough questions from the Chief Justice Roberts, who asked questions like, well, you've been able to elect a black president now twice. clearly you can't be saying you still need this part of the Voting Rights Act. If voting discrimination still existed, how would you be able to elect an African American to the highest office in the land? You got one twice, and you still want the Voting Rights Act? And it was interesting, because in its brief challenging the Voting Rights Act, Alabama argued that times had changed. They'd even changed in Alabama. So we don't need things like the Voting Rights Act here in Alabama. And it's interesting, because if you look at Alabama and how it voted in 2008, black voters in Alabama, in 2008, when President Obama first ran, overwhelmingly supported him. 99% of black voters in Alabama supported the president with their votes on election day. White voters, 10%. 10% of white voters in Alabama pulled the lever for President Obama in 2008, contrasted against 99% of black voters. In Mississippi, 11% of white voters, 98% of black voters. Louisiana, 14% of white voters, 98% of black voters. But you got one. And times have changed in Alabama. And though we had a record that we'd assembled before Congress, 15,000 pages deep, reflecting the ongoing salience of race and how people vote and how election officials carry out votes and how legislatures structure their electorate, the Supreme Court, in a devastating 5-4 decision, struck Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, though it had stood for nearly 50 years, and said, look, what we need is for Congress to reevaluate whether the Section 5 is necessary, and if they find it is, they can reenact a constitutional Section 5. And you'll remember the U.S. Congress that we're dealing with wasn't doing a whole lot at that time and hasn't been able to agree to much since. So this devastating decision has sat there for almost 2 years as we've encouraged Congress to respond to it. And I just want to give you a couple examples of what Section 5 did before it was struck. And one of them comes to us from a place called Killmichael, Mississippi. Real story, Killmichael, Mississippi. It's midway between Tupelo, Mississippi and Jackson, Mississippi. It's a small city of about 2,000 people. And in 2000, the census showed that Killmichael, Mississippi was about to become a majority black city, right? It had previously been majority white, and they had never had an African American serve on the city council. So in Killmichael, Mississippi, the city council had always been white, and there had never been an African American to serve on it. Well, the 2000 census showed that Killmichael was now a majority black city, and there was an election coming up, and that black voters were very excited about this reality. The census shows, hey, we're a majority. We may be able to elect a candidate of our choice. Maybe two. We could even maybe get a mayor on the city council. Next slide. I forgot to share this. This is so you can see this. These gentlemen, I don't know if you can see them. This is a trailer home, and there's a gentleman kind of coming out of the trailer home, and you see these. It's adorned by the two Confederate flags in the front. And my last visit to Killmichael, I was struck by this image for lots of reasons. You can imagine why. And so I stopped to take a photograph of this gentleman's home. And he came out. He asked what I was doing. I said, sir, from the highway, I'm taking a photo of your home. And he said, you know, for what purpose? And I said, I'm just interested in it, so I'm just taking a picture, Pastor. And he said, well, you know, you can come on in if you want to. I said, well, I see that the windows appear to be blacked out. And you don't look safe. You don't look safe. So thanks, but no thanks. But I was struck by this particular image, because this obviously doesn't capture everyone in Killmichael, Mississippi, but they're in. These folks live in Killmichael. And so here we are with the 2000 census showing that black folks had become a majority of the city, and an election was coming up. And the all-white city council was fearful of what this might mean for black voters in the city, that they may not have a chance to elect a candidate of choice or more than one. And so what did the good people in Killmichael, Mississippi do? In 2001, with an election coming up, and the reality that black voters are now the majority of the city, the good folks in Killmichael just canceled the election. They just decide, true story. It doesn't look good for the home team. Some of us may lose a seat. We may all lose our seats. Up against that reality, we should just not have an election. But because Section 5 was in place, That was a voting change, which had to be submitted to the Department of Justice to ensure that it wasn't discriminatory. If the good people of Killmichael could proffer some reason why you would just cancel an election, as you've been holding every 2 years for the last 100 years, then the voting change could go through. But because Section 5 was in place, and because the good people of Killmichael couldn't proffer a non-discriminatory reason for not having an election, they were required to have the election. And what do folks think happened in that particular election? Voter turnout was among the highest in the city of Killmichael in that election cycle, and voters showed up en masse excited, and black voters did in fact elect several candidates of their choice to the city council. And this was the first time in the city of Killmichael that an African-American mayor was elected and 3 black city council members. And I share that story. I share that story because that's a recent example of the reality that though we have made tremendous progress in the last 50 years, our work is not complete. And in this moment, when we don't have the protection of this part of the Voting Rights Act, it does beckon us to answer this question here. And that is, you know, what time is it? And in a very serious way, borrowing from Flavor Flav with the clock, we have the figurative clock here. You know, what time is it for us as people of faith? You know, every year we commemorate Black History Month as we must. And in a place like this with 135 years in, you can't beat the history. But the reality is that you and I are alive at this time. And I often think about, of all the times that we could have been born in American history, why did God purpose it for us to be alive here, particularly given the time it is and the challenges that we face? Next slide. And I think for us, what time it is that it is, for us, it's prime time. It really is prime time. It's prime time for us to connect what's happening in our world, and not just in the voting context, in all contexts impacting black folks. It's time for us to connect what's happening in our world with what's in our word. To connect what's happening in our world with what's in our word. And the reality is, if not here, then where will this really happen? If not in the black church, then where will it really happen? And if not us, then who? And I think of Dr. King's classic text, "Where Do We Go From Here?" Folks know that he stole away to Jamaica for many months to write this book in 1967. It was, I think, the last book he wrote before he was assassinated. The book, "Where Do We Go From Here?" Followed the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964, the church bombing in Alabama. Before then, the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And yet, these years later, Dr. King was still asking this question, where do we go from here? And though he asked that essential question, he only said there were only 2 possible options, chaos or community. Where do we go from here? We got 2 options. We go to chaos or we go to community. And I think for us as people of faith, this really is our moment. Because we're called upon in this moment to be a group of people who bend wherever society is toward community. And answering the question, where do we go from here? The answer for us is that we go toward community. We cut through noise, we cut through foolishness, and we bend wherever the society is toward community. And there's an amazing story in the book of First Chronicles about this people of Issachar. And the Bible describes this people of Issachar as people who are very small in number, but who the Bible describes as understanding the times and knowing what to do in their times. And it talks about how the people of Issachar were alive in a very chaotic time because there had been 2 kings who had been anointed to be king, right? Folks know this to be Saul and David. It would be as if there were 2 presidents in the United States and folks were struggling to figure out who to get behind and support. And so the people of Issachar existed in a chaotic time when the question for them was chaos or community. And they were forced to reconcile the fact that 2 kings had been anointed, Saul and David. But the Bible describes them as being critics of their time, who understood those times and knew what to do in those times. And what they decided to do was bend the people's will toward community. The Bible talks about how though they were small, they were very influential, and they were able to move people to support King David. Even some of Saul's own family got behind David as the king. And I think a lot about the people of Issachar, and I'm inspired by that story because though small in number, they were focused on God's call for them to bend people's will toward community. This photo of Ferguson, I think, captures a small group of folks who decided in the midst of chaos to bend the community's will towards community. And you'll see that this is a place where Michael Brown was killed in the middle of the street. And there are these women I learned who are from a small church. And they decided that in the wake of his death, and in light of the reality that the city, though 74% black, had just one African-American on the city council who, frankly, did anybody know that in Ferguson there was an African-American on the city council? Right? Does anybody know who the mayor of Ferguson is? And so the folks in Ferguson were up against the reality that though they were 74% of the population, they really had no political representation. And the city council appoints the city manager. The city manager controls the city police force. The city police force in Ferguson, Missouri, had made many profits by stopping folks as they passed through the city on very low-level traffic offenses. But for a very long time, to be honest, folks in Ferguson weren't thinking about voting much, so voting was very low. Turnout was around 10% among black folks in the city. And then Ferguson happens. Ferguson happens, and there were those who were in the midst of all manner of excitement, passion, and at the same time, chaos. And in this slide, what I love about this slide is that these women recognize that for them, what time it was prime time. And under this tent, you see them assembled there, small in number, but what they're doing is they're conducting a voter registration drive. They decided that what they could do to bend the chaotic situation toward community was to engage people politically. And they did it strategically very near where Michael Brown was murdered. And I love that example because I think that speaks to us. Because when the question is chaos or community, they move people toward community. And I wonder, what if we undertook to do that? If we undertook to think about the ways in which God has gifted us in whatever context, and if we seize the moment to move from chaos to community, to understand our word and the power of it and the God who wrote it and the challenges in our world and connect our word and our world and move folks toward community. You know, there's not a mistake that you and I are alive at this time. I love history. I think about history often. I think about what it may have been like if I was alive before we got to the United States, or worse, if I was alive during the transatlantic slave trade, or when we arrived on these shores or the shores of some other country, and what that must have been like. But for whatever reason, God decided that you and I would be alive at this time. And I think that's because God knew that we could focus on the challenges of our times and be change agents in the midst of them. And that is our charge. We're going to take that very seriously because I think there are opportunities for us as folks who know the time and know what to do in the time to discover new frontiers for the expansion of civil and human rights in whatever context you're most passionate about. And I think about, as I think about our critical moment, one of my favorite quotes from Franz Fanon, who says that each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover its mission, that is, know what time it is, fulfill it, or betray it. Each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover its mission, that is, know what time it is, fulfill it, or betray it. So let's do that. Thank you.